Okay, and here we go. Now, many of you who visit Rents.com or Reverend Ted Pike's site or other sites, it was all over the world on the internet, know that Ted recently lost his wife, Aylin. Aylin was an extraordinary woman. She put up with some remarkable duress, shall we say, as did Ted. And it's quite a story. I know I got email from people who were writing me saying, my God, did you read Ted's story? And I did. So it really had a profound impact on people. I'm very curious to hear Ted describe it in more detail. We've talked several times since then. But Dave and Sharon are looking forward to it as well. And in that, Dave and Sharon are world-renowned in the field of ghost research and the paranormal. They may or may not have the same idea of what happened during these past years with Ted and his wife as Ted does. But that doesn't matter. The idea is that we're here to share information and to hear Ted's story. And so, Ted, are you there?
I am, Jeff.
Hi, welcome.
Thank you.
I want you to meet Dave and Sharon. Sharon is sitting over there on the right. You can see her if you look.
Left.
Left, sorry.
He's on the left.
Okay.
I told you he was letting his hair grow.
Yeah, he is. Say hi, Sharon, to Ted Pike.
Hi, Ted.
Hello, Sharon.
And there's Dr. Dave on the right over there.
Yeah, that's
glad
me.
Glad to know you.
All right. So we have a lot of fun, of course, when we get together here, but this is a very different kind of a subject. And, Ted, why don't you just go ahead and take it from the beginning, and I may have a few things I'd like to ask, for you to elaborate upon, but, it started, and it ended. Or did it end? When you lose someone so important and precious, it's something that's a loss that is never fully, obviously healed. But why don't you tell us as you'd like to, Ted, from the beginning?
Well, I don't think it's possible to understand the 6 years of demonic invasion and attack that we went through without understanding what many people understand about Ted Pike, and that is that I have been totally involved in fighting the Zionist world conspiracy, Jewish supremacism. And this began really very early in my life. My father and mother were Christian conservative activists who tried very, very much in the liberal era before the 60s, even before Barry Goldwater, to bring about a Christian conservative revival in America to counter the prevailing liberalism, which had continued ever since FDR. And my father pioneered a radio program here in the Portland, Oregon area. And one day the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, visited the station and threatened to shut it down if they allowed Reverend Claude Pike to continue speaking against communism.
Huh.
And my parents were aghast. Here's a supposedly Jewish organization, the God's Chosen People, supposed to be against godless communism, about to shut down this radio station for opposing communism. And we would get literature in the mail at that time, like all broadcasters do, suggesting that there was something hidden. There's a hidden agenda behind Judaism, and particularly one piece of information which stuck in my parents' memory. They got a complete statement of the 1918 article by Sir Winston Churchill in the Illustrated Sunday Herald in England, in which he laid out in the clearest possible language that international Jews, revolutionaries, financiers, and so on were entirely behind making communism possible in Russia. And I was had a pretty alert antenna even back then. I've been about 15 years old and was very much a conservative activist. And I started to looking into these things myself even before I was out of high school. But when I was in college, I did locate an entire Babylonian talmud in a theological seminary here in the Portland area. And I thought this was absolutely compelling information. We received other literature, you know, Henry Ford, Charles Lindbergh, other people warning about that God's chosen people were up to no good. And so anyway, I began to see that there was a huge message that needed to be delivered to the evangelical church, that there, this unholy alliance with Judaism, unbelieving Judaism, with world Zionism, was unscriptural, it was disastrous. And so the long and short of it was I began intense study, even when I was in college, not only in the Bible and Bible prophecies concerning Israel, but also in much literature having to do with the Jewish revolutionary movement. And by 1971, when I was out of college, I was about 25, I had a major thesis together, the book Israel, Our Duty, Our Dilemma. It wasn't written, it was in notes and documentation. And I, in the fall of 71, I went up to do some deer hunting and spend a week up into a mountain cabin to write with my typewriter there to begin to write Israel, Our Duty, Our Dilemma. And that night, I experienced terrible attacks on my sleep, racing nightmares. I was awakened about 12 times during the night. I'd never experienced such an assault before in my life upon my mental facilities. And the long and short was I couldn't write a word up there. I was under such attack, I had to come home. When I came home, every night I had the same kind of battering, same kind of resistance, which I believe was a demonic resistance to writing that book. And in fact, that fall, I became so weak, suddenly so weak, I couldn't even walk 500 feet without resting. And that, that weakness continued literally for more than a decade.
10 years of...
total weakness.
Would you describe it now, Ted, as like a chronic fatigue syndrome kind of a thing?
Yeah, very much like extreme chronic fatigue, in which literally I couldn't work more than 6 or 7 hours a week. And if I worked more than maybe 20 minutes of time, even in light work, I could go into a five-day exhaustion relapses, extreme weakness. And I went through a gamut of doctors and tests, and nobody could ever find anything wrong with me. But
what years were these again, Ted, please?
This would be 71 to about 83.
Well, now, that's when that was the first wave of CFS. The first wave of chronic fatigue was in the late 70s.
I know it was very much popularized, but it was not chronic fatigue syndrome.
I understand. I hear what you're saying. But I'm just remembering, and I knew people who were very ill then, but they couldn't even get out of bed, some of them. Wow. We're going to go through the break on this. And Ted, pull the phone a tiny bit further back away.
Okay.
And I think it'll be a little clearer. You're fine, but I just want to make sure it's as good as we can possibly get. By the way, for those of you who don't know and don't listen to the program, Ted has been a guest for many, many years and has single-handedly probably been the reason that this country is not saddled with so-called hate laws to this point. He has mounted incredible one-man heroic stands against it and brought people together to rally behind him and with him. And I played a small role in that over the years, and I just don't know where we'd be without Ted's efforts. And I'm not overstating that at all. The idea of Zionism, by the way, which created, of course, Bolshevism and communism, also got me taken off Portland radio. They were so arrogant, in fact, that they not only called the station owners and managers and told them that unless they dropped me, they would be put on the National Registry of Anti-Semitic Broadcast Stations, but they said that unless you drop rents, we're going to contact every sponsor that sponsors on your station and tell them the same thing. And then these people, Ted, were so arrogant, and you will understand this, that they actually emailed me the form letters they used to have their tree of cohorts deluge the stations with. They sent me the letters, said, here, try and stop us. Ha ha.
Yes.
So that's how ruthless these people are. Anyway, go ahead, Ted.
Yeah, and In 1983, however, I did experience a surge of energy. I was able to write my book, Israel, Our Duty, Our Dilemma. The old Spotlight newspaper was very instrumental in distributing that to the right, and it became a bestseller in its genre. And then in 1987, we produced the Other Israel video, which also filled a tremendous vacuum, sold some 10 or 12,000 copies just in the first several months. But meanwhile, in 1983, I had fallen in love and married my beautiful wife, Lynn. And she was a remarkable person, not only in her beauty, but in her determination to speak the whole truth and stand by her man while he did it. Her mother had researched the Talmud and Elizabeth Dilling's writings and so on. And so Lynn was prepared to be joined together in marriage with me in a really holy cause of speaking the whole truth, going forth through publishing, through video, to awaken the church and the nation.
Mm-hmm.
And then around 2000, again, we launched forth into creating major videos. The first one was Hate Laws Making Criminals of Christians. We realized very clearly that the Anti-Defamation League was solidly behind attempts to turn America into a hate crimes bureaucracy, just like Canada, taking away free speech, persecuting
right.
free thinkers, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then around 2003, Lynn was diagnosed with a benign brain tumor. She went through surgery for 8.5 hours.
What were the symptoms? Did she begin to have problems?
She had some headaches and so on. It wasn't major problems, but she had a seizure in traffic, and I thought she had died.
Oh.
And we rushed her. The emergency came,
mm-hmm.
took her to a hospital,
mm-hmm.
and she was diagnosed. That left her in a weakened condition, fully rational. But
eight and a half hours of surgery.
Yeah, it was major surgery for a fairly large tumor in her right frontal lobe of her brain.
Wow.
But the most significant thing tonight we're talking about was in the fall of 2005, she and I were out in nature in a large rock quarry out in the woods, and suddenly she saw all kinds of fantastic activity in the sky. It was kind of I likened it to an aurora borealis, kind of like Van Gogh's Starry Night, the painting in which the whole sky was turbulent and flashing red light and pink and all kinds of lights, and she saw the large silhouette of a black figure in the sky off to the west. And
you were not able to see anything.
I didn't see a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't see anything, but she was absolutely enraptured by what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so this began as we drove home. She said she could see lights in the along the road, in the trees, and actually in our car. And then
What kind of lights in the trees? Little round lights moving around?
All kinds of, often primarily purple type of lights, red lights, very, very clear lights. And they would be a profusion of lights. Not only that, but all throughout the sky, she would see the stars zigzagging around and shooting around, all kinds of phenomena in the heavens and so on. But as we got back into our home in the days that followed, we experienced a complete menagerie of all kinds of demonic manifestations, lights, and
supernatural
phenomena.
What I'd like you to do, if you would, is just slow down a little bit, because I really want to hear about these things. Now, let me also preface this by saying you have never studied or been a researcher in the field of the paranormal. You didn't. What was your stance on paranormal events at that time?
Well, I certainly believed that demons could manifest themselves. In fact, I'd experienced a few things that were very strange. Certainly, in my experience, when I got back from the mountain cabin, I experienced dozens, literally dozens of demonic attacks at night in which extreme evil forces would come upon me. They would lock onto me. There'd be a roaring sound or maybe a trumpet sound or an extreme vibrating sound, kind of like a short electrical short circuit.
Mm-hmm.
I would experience in which I would be sucked down into a, seemingly like down into a different reality, and I would cry out and to Christ in the blood of Jesus to deliver me, and then I would come out of it after 30 seconds or a minute or whatever. Very, very scary stuff. So I was very aware that demonic powers existed and could assault us, particularly as we are going out against evil.
Right, right. Okay, now you did, when you called for Jesus' help and so forth, you did get relief. It did work.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
that's important.
I would be totally paralyzed, just locked in by these forces.
Uh-huh. Well, there are a lot of people who work in the field of the paranormal who do so-called entity work in peoples, where there are dark forces or dark entities that have invaded people and taken charge of them, and they do encourage people, some of them, to invoke the name of Jesus and command these entities or entity to leave the body immediately. And many people report that it works for them. And so it's interesting to hear you relate that as well. All right. Okay. So these events began to happen, I guess, fairly routinely.
Yeah. They communicated through her voice box, and she began to babble routinely in unknown
tongues. Excuse me. Forgive my interruption. We're old friends. But is this speaking in tongues or what?
Yeah. Well, I don't know how it's any different than the glossolalia of the Pentecostals, really. Babbling, yes. And one of the interesting things about the vocalizations of these demons was every day, literally every day, they would mention two names. The first one was Baal Shem Tob. They would say Baal Shem Tob Teddy or Baal Shem Toba. And when something really clicked when they would say that, because I know Baal Shem Tob to be the founder of Hasidic or Kabbalistic Judaism, ultra-Orthodox Judaism.
Hmm.
He was an 18th century Jewish mystic, Kabbalist in Poland, who was really one of the arch conspirators and founders of the modern world revolutionary movement. And out of the Kabbalism of a Jewish subversive activity coming out of Poland, you have radiating out people like Weishaupt and Saint Germain and Cagliostro and Frank and Falk and all of these Jewish revolutionary conspirators leading to the French Revolution, leading to the revolutions in Europe and ultimately to communism. And I realized that coming out of the synagogue of Satan, there was some kind of a curse upon us. Baal Shem Tob is a highly venerated founder and architect of modern Hasidic or the Haredi in Israel today, the Kabbalistic Jews today. And there was very clearly a link here, coming from a Judaic source in these attacks. And then the second name, which was repeated constantly for 6 years, every day, would be Shabbatai. And again, it seemed to me very clearly a reference to Shabbatai Zevi, who was the Turkish Jewish Messiah of the Jews, who in 1646 declared himself Messiah of the Jews and convulsed world Jewry in anticipation of world control, even at that time. But again, he was the founder of the Shabbatean branch of subversive Jewry, leading to ADL, B'nai B'rith, communism.
Well, they
so
say
on.
That the Sabbateans are the forerunners, of course, and continue to propel world Zionism. And
yes, absolutely.
That's very chamish.
The Sabbateans have been known for their utter ruthlessness, deception. Sabbatai Zeb set the standard. The Sultan of Turkey said, "Well, if you're really the Messiah, let my people shoot you through with arrows. And if you're the Messiah, you'll be invulnerable." And so he renounced being Messiah, but he covertly continued to continue his Kabbalistic plan for world control. And that subterfuge, by way of deception, Mossad type of subterfuge has distinguished a communist, even Zionist, underhanded tactics ever since.
Well, we're still faced with it. World Bolshevism is not dead, and the Communist Manifesto is being implemented at a faster and faster rate here in this country. There's no doubt. You can go back to the Congressional Record in 1962 and read the whole thing. It was read into the record, and most of those key goals have already been met. It's scary, for sure. Okay, we just have a couple minutes till the break. Sharon, any questions just at this point that you'd like elaborated upon? We'll get to an analysis later, but anything?
I really don't have any questions at this point.
Okay.
No.
David?
No, I'm enjoying what his experiences.
Yeah, it's quite a story. These names were unmistakable, clear, and Ted and I have talked about this. Was your wife shocked when you told her that these voices were bringing these two names almost daily or daily to you?
Well, she was kind of unshockable. There were so many things happening to her. She certainly had no idea who Baal Shem Tov or Shabbatai Zevi would be.
Oh, really?
No, she had a rudimentary understanding of what the Kabbalah is all about, but actually having a familiar knowledge with those people like I had was unknown. That's what makes it most remarkable, because if indeed she was suffering a post-traumatic stress as a result of the brain surgery and was hallucinating or whatever, how would she have known to invoke and bring up the names of two of the most crucial kingpins in the modern world revolutionary movement?
Well, the Sabbateans certainly are as dark and dirty as it gets.
Yes.
There's no doubt about that. What are some of the other physical manifestations of strange energies working, perhaps through your wife, perhaps just visiting your home, as it were?
Well, we had... She could feel powerfully the demons in presence in her throat and upper chest, and constantly chattering in her brain. They would powerfully resist her attempts to pray, and our house was filled with clicking sounds and streaking lights and whirring presences.
Describe the streaking lights for me, would you?
Well,
please?
It's just a kind of a disturbance, a flashing disturbance across the ceiling. We would see lights streaking by outside like a fireball shooting out across our yard in the night. All kinds of lights. She would constantly see lights in the house, purple lights, glowing lights everywhere. Even she would look into my eyes a number of times and see my eyes glowing green or eyes glowing purple.
Well, the idea of orbs and red lights streaking around and moving around homes and through walls. Of homes and right through rooms is not unusual in the UFO research field. That's something that I've heard for, well, long, long time about. Sure. So some of those things, there are overlays there. That's interesting. When you say whirring noises or whirring events, what were those about?
Well, the demons, there would be a turbulence around them sometimes when you would step into a room, suddenly there'd be a clattering. As they would be disturbed, they would sometimes they would like they'd go rushing across the floor and underneath a carpet underneath a sofa or so on, disturbing all of the cloth or the drapery. There'd be a turbulence, and whether it was in as I say whirring across the ceiling or whirring around the floor. They were there, and oftentimes when we would step into a room, things would bang down, there'd be a clatter, a disturbance. I'm not exactly sure whether they were actually surprised.
Uh-huh.
But,
were things ever broken, Ted? Pushed over, knocked over and broken, or just...
I can't think of anything was broken,
uh-huh.
but... One of the manifestations of the demons, which was extremely prevalent, almost on a not maybe a daily basis, but very frequently, was all kinds of dematerializations of objects, familiar objects.
That I want to follow up on. We have to take a break. Hang on, and we will continue with Reverend Ted Pike. Okay, and we're back. Dave and Sharon, and yours truly, we're doing 3 hours tonight. We spent another hour with Ted and hear his story. Many of the things Ted is describing are probably familiar to many of you in terms of paranormal activity, poltergeist activity, hauntings, and so forth. There are many different ways to interpret these things. We don't pretend to have all the answers, but it's a fascinating story in any case. How, before we get to the dematerialization thing, how was Aylin doing during all this physically? How was her health holding up, her emotional and physical health? This is a very difficult load to carry, no matter what the cause.
Well, you have to remember, she was a real fighter. She was dedicated to getting the truth out at any cost. In fact, she made it very clear to the Almighty that she was willing to suffer, willing to pay any price to stand by me and hold back the evil. It's true, after the surgeries especially, she was weakened. And by the way, when we were married, literally the same day we were married, she took on my weakness, not voluntarily, but suddenly she became very weak also, and for the next decade also was unexplainably exhausted. This was a spiritual warfare she was in. She knew it with great clarity, and even though the demons were attacking her mind, attacking her emotions, and in many ways, she basically had mental spiritual equilibrium during this whole thing.
All right, very good. Dematerialization. What? Give me some examples, Ted.
Well, what we have to understand, what we saw so clearly, was that the demonic forces are empowered with an understanding and a technological ability, a mastery over physical reality, which is far, far above anything our principles of physics have any comprehension about.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just give you a few anecdotes. She needed special prismatic glasses, and they took her glasses for 6 months, just took them away. And then finally, she got a $600 replacement pair of glasses. And as she was walking in the house with her new glasses, we looked on the sofa that we had sat upon innumerable times, and there were her original pair of glasses sitting there.
Hmm.
And then another time, she was about 7 miles from home. She was shopping, and suddenly her car keys were whisked out of her hand, disappeared out of her hand. We had to send a special car.
She had the keys in her hand, and they vanished?
She had the keys in her hand, and they vanished right out of her hand. And mysteriously vanished, and we, of course, had a separate set at home, and we continued using that replacement set of keys for a week. We would never leave the keys in the car, but one morning we went out to the garage, and here were the original keys in the ignition. They had taken them 7 miles away, and they had transported them through space right back into our car ignition.
Brad Steiger has been on the program for I don't know how long now. He would understand this phenomenon very, very well, and does. He would call it the borrowers. People call them the borrowers, but yes, materialization and dematerialization, again, not completely uncommon. Fascinating to see and experience. I wouldn't want to do it, but I think most of us have lost little things once in a while, and all of a sudden they're right there. It's weird how that happens. Yeah, it's happened to me. Yeah.
Another an anecdote was one time she told me to go to her handbag where she kept her cosmetics to get some lipstick or something out of it. I reached down into the handbag, and she said that it was in the zippered section on the side of the handbag. Well, I felt along the side of the handbag, and it was perfectly smooth. It was just perfectly smooth plastic. There was no zippered section in her handbag. I said, honey, there's no zippered section. What are you talking about? So she came over to show me where the zippered section in her handbag was, and to her astonishment, it was gone with all of her cosmetics. But a couple hours later, she went to the same bag, and there was where was the zippered section attached to the side of her handbag with everything that she routinely kept there. And another time, and this is very disturbing, but this is very true. She, as a result of these attacks, she developed unaccountable, unexplainable pain in her knees. She was a lifetime runner. She had remarkable athletic ability. And yet, crippling knee pain, which defied diagnosis by specialists, set in. And she was at the track, and she asked a tall and handsome young runner there what he thought she should do concerning her knee problems. And he said, well, just continue running to the full extent until the pain becomes unendurable. Doesn't sound like good advice to me, but he turned away, and she watched him as he dematerialized into a chain-link fence. He disappeared right in front of her eyes. And she said, Eureka, she said, I have a coach who's an angel. She believed he was an angel of God, and he was giving her angelically inspired wisdom. So she began to run according to his advice, as she blew out her knees and could never run again.
Oh.
Now, in my opinion, she saw a demon in human form, and that gives you an idea of the fantastic, almost godlike magical abilities of these demons to materialize even in something as complex as the human body.
Well, one thing that Brad and I have always warned about, and I'm sure Dave and Sharon agree, is that Ouija boards are not something to mess with. You can invite a lot of trouble in real fast, especially to young minds who are completely unprepared for any of it. So the other side has a lot of ugly and dangerous material over there, power.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ted.
Just one more. And by the way, I am reading from the notes I have. I have a 12-page article, which we do have posted at truthtellers.org. Giving the whole detailed scenario
right.
of everything that happened. Or I wouldn't say everything, because there were thousands of events, often repeating the same thing. But
really, thousands? You're not exaggerating. You're thousands.
No, thousands.
But
when you have her seeing light, and she only reported to me, she was determined she wasn't going to burden me with all the strange things that were happening. But she was seeing light. She was hearing voices. She was seeing things. And she wouldn't even tell me, because she believed I had to save the world and shouldn't be distracted. So what's important, I think, when people read my article, is to realize that I do give a preponderance of my own testimony of what I saw with my own eyes, because people may legitimately claim that there's a woman who had massive brain surgery and was delusional, but I saw too many incredible things here. And I relate many, many more of these in this article. But just another little anecdote, and there's so many of these in the article. I've seen lids fly across our kitchen, and just several months ago, I have a huge book on Michelangelo. I was sitting on a chair in the kitchen, and suddenly I heard a large bang, and that large volume went crashing to the floor underneath the chair on which it was sitting. So either it went through the chair, or it took an arc around the side of the chair with great force enough to make a large bang.
And
another time she had sealed a letter ready for mailing, and then she couldn't find it, and we found it wedged tightly behind the containers in the back of our refrigerator, showing that they can shoot even a letter, something as fragile as a letter, wedge it between solid objects right through the door of a refrigerator.
Now, there's another thing I want to bring up. This is not what happened to you and your wife, but there is a type of stalking to attempt to drive people insane or crazy,
mm-hmm.
or force them to move, and that involves entering the home when people are not there and moving things. One woman in Houston described a litany of things. She was about nuts until she realized that somebody was doing it. They'd come in and they'd turn something upside down. They'd move the furniture. One time they unscrewed the door to her washing machine dryer. It wasn't off, but it was completely loose. And then they came back the next day and tightened it up. Stuff like that.
Yes.
So, but that's a different thing. When you see a lid from a pot flying across the room, that's classic poltergeist activity, which is almost invariably tied to a teenage girl living in the home. There's something about young female, or perhaps female energy, that elicits or empowers or is involved with or attracts this kind of energy that can make things move and fly around the house. It's just too many stories, too many stories. All right, Ted, hold on just a second, if you would, and we'll come right back with Reverend Ted Pike as Dave and Sharon and yours truly continue. Okay, and we're back talking to Ted Pike, who has experienced, I don't know how you continue to function, given a man of your faith and your mission in life to try to inform, taking care of a wife. Obviously, you were very close, who was so stricken with these experiences, not to mention the brain surgery, but somehow you persevered. That's amazing.
Well, they tried to make it hard for me to continue to send out my weekly email alerts, writings about the federal hate bill threat and Jewish supremacism and abuses by Israel and so on. In fact, literally, according to the clock, when I would be ready to send out an important e-alert, or even when I would be working on it, they would be screaming. The demons fairly quickly made it clear that they did not mind having their names divulged to me. And they became presences, particularly one demon by the name of Pitka, set himself up. He described himself through Alin's voice as her private demon. And every time I would be in the last stages of getting an e-alert, he would set up a tremendous howling, screaming, no, 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 at the top of Alin's lungs.
You say at the top of Alin's lungs, she was...
Yes.
She was the medium through which the spirit entity was...
He communicated through her voice
box. Okay, so she was shrieking. Did her voice change, Ted, like in the movies?
The
sound of her voice?
Many changes as the demons, according to the particular situation. Let me get back to that in just a second. I'll just say that...
Sure.
He would set up a protest, and often my materials would be stolen. This was a recurrent problem. In fact, it continues to this very hour.
Electronically stolen?
Yeah, the dematerialization of important documents, articles, mm-hmm. notes, and things like that. For example, just to show you their powers, I had about 7 pages of notes for an important article, and then suddenly, I think it was page 5, disappeared. They were stapled together. A staple was holding together 7 pages of documents, and then page 5 disappeared for several hours. I literally felt through those stapled pages, and
uh-huh.
the page was gone. And then about 2 hours later, here was page 5 back in its proper place. And but it's always been, and it continues to be, literally a battle of wits to try to hang on to important documents because of the spiritual resistance coming from them.
Very interesting. Okay. All right.
One of the characteristics of the demonic invasion was the assault upon anything having to do with telephones and electronics in our house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scripture describes Satan and Lucifer, the demons, as the prince of the power of the air. And I believe that they do have tremendous power literally in the airwaves, in the communication industry, the Jewish supremacist domination of the media. That is their realm, satanic power in telecommunications, and especially in the promotion of evil ideas that corrupt men and take away freedom.
Oh, they
but
sure
what
do.
We noticed,
yeah, yeah.
What we noticed very, very distinctly, very powerfully and shockingly, in very short order after the experience in the quarry, was that they took over our telephone. They took over our cell phones, so it became impossible for us to communicate by cell phones. They would block communication, and we would get innumerable garbled messages with all kinds of reverberating sounds and conversations. We could hear on our phones conversations with voices coming to us of trusted friends, but with false messages, false conversations we had never heard. All kinds of scrambled messages, etc. And another example was of the having to do with this strange electrical disturbances was our car one evening here, very soon afterwards, began to flash with all of the lights in the front lights and the rear lights flashing constantly
mm-hmm.
for at least a half an hour. The lights on inside and very loud clicking sounds going on in our car. The whole car was just alive. We stood back aghast that our car was just a light show of demonic activity.
Wow. Well, okay. Remarkable, to say the least. So you are not just, again, I want to be sure everyone understands, you are an active participant and witness to all of this, or most of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Again, I'm very aware, and we've encountered this criticism quite widely in various shows and in response to our articles, that somehow these were the private delusions of a woman suffering from brain surgery. But I saw literally hundreds of these things myself, very strange things. For example, one time we were out just walking in nature, and Lynn said, look at those beautiful squares against the forest. And she said there was a lattice of grass-green squares against the trees, and I hadn't been looking in that direction, but I looked over there, and sure enough, here, superimposed on an evergreen forest, was this very precise and very clear grid of green shapes. And
you saw it, too.
Yeah, I did. And another thing was these lights would assail her. One time we were out on the highway, and it was in the middle of a thunderstorm, and we stopped just to kind of enjoy the thunderstorm in a church parking lot. And she said that there were lights like cannonballs just shooting down on her from the heavens. And another time I was out in the night with her as she was under attack, and I literally saw a star explode with all the infinite detail of a, as I write in my article, of a jet being hit by a surface-to-air missile. A star exploded in front of me, and that just showed the rarefied demonic activity that they were even affecting my sight. She exclaimed many times that while she was driving down the road, lights would shoot at her at terrific speed coming toward her on the highway, attempting to cause her to swerve.
Well, like a small round light? And
yeah.
Or coming right, and then it would go through the car, around the car, over the car?
I don't know. She said they would come streaking down the highway.
Huh.
Very, very soon, she noticed and described this, of course, as we would drive. She would say that the bumpers of the cars in front of her were all lit up with neon colors.
Hmm.
The trees were glowing.
Wow. What an incredible world she lived in and experienced.
Yeah, yeah. And especially when we were coming home from our weekly Bible studies, which we host two nights a week at a separate location.
Mm-hmm.
She said that on the return home trips from a good Bible study, the whole highway in front of her would be a kind of a carnival of lights, flashing lights, swirling lights, lights in all kinds of symmetrical
wow.
patterns in front
right.
of her.
Hold on a second, Ted. We have to pause. We'll come right back. What a challenge for anyone to live through, let alone a couple like you. Back in a minute. Hi, Ted. Another half hour to go, so let's kind of walk through this in terms of what happened to Alin and where you are today. And I just it's amazing to me you were able to carry on. You never said anything. You always took care of your business on the radio, on your own programs, and so forth that you do. And just amazing. All right, go ahead.
Well, it became clear that the demons wanted to kill Alin. In fact, from the very, very first, they told her, I should say that the demons came in a very great multitude. There were many of them. In fact, they told her, and I heard them say this through her voice box, that they wanted to kill her and that it was no use because they were too many. And, as I said earlier, gradually it became clear that most of the other demons had left, and Pitka, the demon Pitka, was stationed here as her private demon, and he was a presence every day, a personality here. It's kind of like a mafia figure setting up house in a household of a business or something, taking control in order to extort money out of the people, whatever. This demonic figure stayed here as our personal presence. We would drive far away, and suddenly he would announce his presence. One time we were far away, and he says, I want you to know I'm here. I'm Pitka. And I said, well, that's not surprising.
Now, is he speaking through Alin's voice?
Yes, he's speaking through Alin. Okay. So Pitka was with us everywhere. Of course, could travel without any kind of restraints. But it became clear that the demons were intent upon killing Alin, and certainly driving her crazy and even starving her to death and so on. There was a full-scale attempt to destroy her, and in the process, hopefully destroy my ministry, destroy my outreach of trying to save freedom. There, on a number of occasions, the demonic forces came through with such tremendous intensity that she was literally driven crazy. The first time, I was just about to go on the radio with John Stadtmiller back about 2006, fighting the federal hate bill. I was literally minutes, if not within an hour, of going on Republic with him. And the demons came through with a tremendous intensity of obsessive verbalizations coming through her. She became totally deranged, stripped off her clothes, and was wild and raving. And we had to call an ambulance to come and get her and take her to a mental health facility. But just exactly as that was going on, I was about to go on the air with John. I quickly had to call Republic and say that I'd be about 3 minutes late, but as they were coming to get her, I did go on the air and gave a good broadcast for an hour with him, and of course saying nothing of what I was going on at the home level. She was taken to a mental hospital, and just about as soon as she got there, she was perfectly rational, and I came a day or so later and got her. And another time, but I was determined never to let her be taken off and put in a solitary room, which was very traumatic for her. Another time that happened, same thing, and we decided to wrap her up and tie her up in a blanket, and for about 36 hours she raved with obscenities and an intensity of speech, a rapidity and intensity of speech you would not even believe the human mind could be capable of. And then suddenly, about 36 hours later, it suddenly stopped, and she couldn't remember a thing.
I have a question, please.
Yeah.
At any time after her brain surgery, did you present these circumstances and events and occurrences to her brain surgeon, her surgical team, her neurologist, and ask them if there could be any relationship? Did you ever even raise that with the medical community?
She had a psychiatrist after the brain surgery. I did try to say this, and he wouldn't even listen to me. It was too fantastic.
He wanted
to get to real science, real cause and effect, according to his cosmology.
I got it. Okay. All right. Well said. Okay. Go ahead.
But as we near the end of the program, maybe I better start moving toward the events which led to her death. She was feeling really good in September. One day in September, we decided to take a picnic lunch and drive down the Willamette Valley here and have an outing. And she went into a Safeway store, into the restroom for quite a long time. And when she came out, she was absolutely ashen with fear. She said she had heard me calling her inside the restroom, and she had the most acute conviction that she was ready to go to hell. She was so evil that the only thing she could do, should now do, is to kill herself in order to save our ministry and to purge out the evil influence in my life. Well, this was absolutely astonishing, because no one was more obedient to God and kind and loving a Christian as she was. We went down to the place where we had our picnic, and she was so struck, absolutely struck with the evil in her life, that she went out into a field and she lay down on her face in the grass, in the stubble, for a full hour on her in prostration, absolutely astonished at how evil she was. And gradually I was able to bring her back to reality, that this was a demonic attack. They were trying to kill her and force her to commit suicide. And I brought her back to reality, and we came home. But in the ensuing month or so, we had about another 12 of those attacks, in which she would begin to tremble and stare fixedly into space with this absolute obsession that she must kill herself. Now, Pitka had been yelling, "Kill, kill, and kill Ted, and kill Ted Nile," and all of that kind of stuff.
Now, when she was verbalizing his voice, would she be doing it conversationally? But you say yelling. I guess sometimes she would yell.
When he was yelling, "Kill, kill, or kill Ted," it was absolutely a scream. I would have to put my fingers in the air, in my ears. It was so intense, so loud, triple forte, just screaming in rage.
And now let me say one other thing. There is, and has been patented for 30 years now, something called voice-to-skull technology, which allows the transmission of the human voice. Let's just keep it simple. I pick up a microphone. It's hooked up to a machine. There's a microwave dish. A block and a half away is Ted Pike. I start talking into the microphone. Ted Pike hears my voice in his head. This is actual technology. I'm not saying that's what happened here.
Yeah.
But they let's just assume that there's a chance this could have been partly a Zionist effort to drive you both crazy. There is that technology out there to partly manifest hallucinations of sound in the mind. I just wanted to put that out there.
It's kind of like saying that you're part of a, you yourself are some part of a very bizarre scheme of mind control talking to me right now. Pitka was a real personality, a flexible, real, thinking, accusing, evasive personality who could be talked to just exactly like I'm talking
Was he always there, Ted?
Yeah, he was always here.
So if you would she go into a different facial state when she began to talk like him?
Oh, very, very much so. I could tell when Pitka was especially speaking through her. They would take her face and they would create distortions, monstrous masks of facial expression on her face. You would not believe. You could not believe it was the same person.
Didn't look that well. There's how many 52 facial muscles?
And
they would make
she was a remarkably beautiful woman, but they would make an ogre out of her face.
And
even when it was not in the most extreme form, I could see this strange, twisted look between her eyes when the demons were on her.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened, though, in September of this year was a new dimension of demonic attack, in which they were literally going to her conscience, going not to her soul, but they were going to her very identity of her brain and convincing her in spells that she was so evil, so irredeemably, and she had committed the unpardonable sin that all faith could not work for her. It could work for other people, but it was in vain to trust Jesus anymore. And so she began to express suicidal thoughts. In fact, one night she wrote a 7-page suicide letter, which she gave to me the next morning and said she had been packing up her things and actually planning on jumping into the river. I looked at this, and let me just preface this by saying,
sure,
after the surgery, she had a tendency to be tremulous in her hand, in her handwriting. She had a tendency with her ADD problems to be kind of rambling in her writings and so on. But this was a 7-page letter in perfect handwriting, in short, clear, direct sentences, enumerating her hundreds of terrible sins that she was guilty of. This was a classic example of automatic handwriting coming from the demons. And I actually took the letter, I glanced at it, and I had to get rid of it. It was such an abomination. But it was clear they were coming for her. They were coming in a very intent program to lure her into actually throwing herself into the river. And to make a long story short, that's exactly what happened. One night I was awakened by the police at around midnight, and Lynn had thrown herself into the Clackamas River,
mm-hmm.
Into the rapids. But as she was drifting downstream, a voice in her said, well, maybe there's a slim possibility that I am not as bad as I think I am. And she was able to scramble out of the water and make her way to help.
Mm-hmm.
And she had swallowed a huge amount of drugs, the Geodon and Excedrin. They were pumping her stomach out there in the hospital, and I came and I was able again to orient her and bring her back to reality. And I should mention that when she went into these delusional states, if I were asleep or away, that's when the demons would hit her with this. But when I would come, begin to reason with her very quickly, she would come back to reality. She would say, oh, I do love Jesus. I do trust him. I don't want to go to hell. I believe in God and salvation and all of that. She'd very quickly reaffirm the true identity and mission of her life. But the power of the demons to take her mind, her physical mind, not her soul, because the only way they could convince her to try to kill herself was to convince her that by doing so, she would be assisting my ministry by removing such a wicked person from my presence.
Wow. All right. Okay. So that was September, and she did throw herself in the river but got out at one time. So what happened?
Well, the medical personnel were very, very adamant that she must go to a psychiatric unit and
mm-hmm.
and have extensive testing of antipsychotic drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, I knew that for the most part she was not psychotic, but it was clear that these seizures, these new delusions of her evil, were clearly psychotic breaks. And I knew what the whole cause was. I knew the cause and effect very clearly. But I went along with them, and she went to a psychiatric facility for about 12 days, and Pitka was there. He was twisting her face around. He was causing her to babble, but she was...
Did the staff see this?
Yeah, oh, they saw that, but she passed it off as the effects of the brain surgery. And so they took it in stride. They dismissed her and said they didn't think that she was psychotic. And,
really? So she, in other words, covered... At the hospital,
behavior. Yeah, that was a grace that I told her she should take to, rather than appear foolish, just
yeah.
to say that it was the result of the brain surgery.
Well,
and
wow, that's amazing. It's also
yeah.
said by most paranormal researchers that I know that taking drugs, even alcohol, anything that alters your baseline consciousness will open the door to the other side to allow other energies to come in more easily. So that's what happened here, but just a footnote. All right, go ahead, Ted.
So we brought her home, and she was kind of bruised and traumatized by the experience for several days, but then she brightened. She became her old self again. I should mention that during this whole thing, she was witty, she was kind, she was communicative, she was her lovely self much of the time, but it was interspersed with often severe attacks.
What, 90% Alin and 10%?
Yeah, 80% Alin, 20%, that would be a pretty good division of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the day before she died, in fact, in this article, which people can read at truthtellers.org, we do have a link to her last telephone message to me. I had arranged for her to be involved in some structured activities, including therapy groups, and she had gone to one of these therapy groups on a Monday afternoon, and she was really an inspiration to people, a natural leader and a blessing to them. And she went down to the river to enjoy the last of the autumn leaves, and she leaves a very wonderful message, which people can read by linking out of this article at Truth Tellers. The point I'm trying to make is that 24 hours before her death, she was full of optimism for life, and never did she contemplate suicide out of reasons of depression or hopelessness in life, only as a result of this delusion that was necessary to purify our ministry. And then that was 24 hours before, but the next afternoon, in fact, I had exclaimed to her earlier in the day she died, how radiant she looked. I told her that no one would ever have dreamed that she had been in a mental hospital or had attempted suicide. She had renewed her health insurance. She had a long grocery list. She was going to go to town to get a swimming suit and be involved in swimming activities and so on. She was happy. She was bright. But I'd been up since about 3 o'clock in the morning, but I noticed just as I was about to go down for a nap that she had a stare. She was staring forward. She was trembling. But I'd seen so many examples of that kind of bizarre behavior that I just had to commit her to God. And when she brightened a bit, I said, okay, go into town. I've got to take a nap. So I took my nap, but I was awakened from my sleep by the ringing of the telephone. And again, it was the police, the deputy, who told me that it seemed that Alin had actually thrown herself off the Markham Bridge in Portland. Now, just before she left, my sister-in-law saw her and was taken aback because Alin seemed to be in a trance-like state, not even hardly recognizing my sister-in-law. And then before Alin left the place, she talked briefly with a carpenter who was working on at our place, and he said she gave him a really, really strange feeling. She seemed to be in a trance, actually looking through him. So she was very powerfully involved in a major demonic delusional attack, that the time to kill herself had come again, even though many times she had said even mm-hmm. since the hospital, she would never, never consider mm-hmm. doing such mm-hmm. a thing again.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 6 o'clock, Tuesday on December 6th, she did stop her car at the middle of the Markham Bridge.
How tall is that bridge, Ted?
Well, it's 130 feet to the icy waters of the Willamette River.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And evidently, she went over the railing. And, of course, in fact, almost immediately, divers and boats went out after her. But she still remains in the Willamette River. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's been flooding so much now, I believe she may be taken mm-hmm. out to the ocean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you came on my program not more than 3 days after that.
Yeah, it'll be 3 days after.
And it is remarkable that you could continue. You want to tell people why and how it is that you were able to continue like that?
Well, Lynn's very greatest desire is that the truth go forward and that we continue to redeem the time by speaking the whole truth and warning against these great evils, especially coming from Jewish supremacism. She would have wanted me to go on your program and have the opportunity of speaking that truth to probably tens of thousands of people.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I gave a major Bible study the previous day. I sent out an e-alert the day after her death. And some people have said, well, this sounds callous. This sounds disrespectful. Absolutely not. I have the most vivid awareness that she is now in the presence of God. She's with her beloved mother. She's absolutely free from these demons. She's having peace and happiness and joy that is beyond the ability of the human mind to comprehend. And this is what authentic Christianity is all about. Scripture says, we do not mourn as others mourn who have no hope. You see, I shed my tears. No woman was more loved by her husband. No woman was more interceded to by God, by her husband in this situation. But I knew that she wanted me to speak, and she would have wanted me to take any opportunity I could have in order to get the truth out.
Wow. Well, that is an extraordinary story, which is not nearly over. You have so much more to do yet. Her joining you at that period in your life when the work was actually at its most critical was an amazing example of two people working together, because I know you would not have been able to do what you did without having someone like that in your life.
Yes.
I know how hard, how many years. Altogether, how many years were you married?
We were married 27 years.
Mm-hmm. They don't do that anymore, Ted.
she was a very, very sensitive, artistic, creative person. She was a co-host in four of my major videos.
Mm-hmm.
We do have a 20-minute remembrance video of her also available at Truth Tellers, and people can see some clips of her in fighting action there, fighting the hate bill, fighting Jewish supremacism and injustices against the Palestinians and so on. She was a remarkable woman, a mainstay of my creative and spiritual ministry.
Wow, that's an amazing hour and a half. You've done a marvelous job of presenting it. Is there anything? We've got about a minute left, Ted. Anything you want to add to wrap it up? Obviously, you're not about to rest one moment as long as there is an enemy on the planet. And that enemy is threatening yours truly, every one of you listening, all Americans in our way of life.
Well, there's a... As you mentioned, I think at least more than 30 blogs and websites have shown the video. It has traveled around the world. I was on with a huge KXL program here in Portland with Clyde Lewis, which has 250,000 downloads every month. The story has circled the globe. But what I want to point out is that even though there are lots of theories about the dynamics behind this, and there's some skepticism, but overwhelming a gratitude that I brought the story out and belief in this story. The dynamics are very simple, a simple cause and effect. I believe that I was led, even as a young man of 25, to go out single-handedly to fight Jewish supremacism and try to redeem and ransom the evangelical church out of the darkness it's in its unholy alliance with Judaism. And I believe that was the cause, and the effect was this demonic backlash. A demonic backlash. It's very simple. There are demonic forces that opposed to what I was doing.
No question that thought is energy, and collective thought is even more energy. And you were, and your wife, very much despised by the evil ones. There's no question about that. Ted, thank you for being here. It's really an honor. Take care.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, good night.
Good night.